How do you manage multiple jobs, passions, hobbies, continued education, kids, a marriage, and still make time for yourself? My guest, Dr. Vinitha Menon, is a superwoman in my eyes because she manages all of that plus some. Vinitha has spent her career as a school and clinical psychologist focused on helping people ask for what they need while honoring everything that makes them unique. Whether teaching voice lessons, leading multicultural youth groups, training grad students in psychology, or mentoring early career psychologists, she has found a way to share her experiences in an approachable, practical way. Through every aspect of Vinitha's life, whether she's a parent, immigrant, friend, coach, and psychologist, she has learned that everyone needs and deserves community. But you can't sacrifice who you are to get it. Stay tuned to learn more about Vinitha and her experiences in this episode of Ignite the Change. Welcome to Ignite the Change. I'm your host, Bushra. I'm a licensed clinical social worker working as a mental health therapist in private practice. Before private practice, I worked with first-generation high school and college students across the city and suburbs of Chicago. Ignite the Change is a space where we're able to hear from talented mental health clinicians as they share how they navigated this profession. You'll hear stories of identity, family, education, and more. Through powerful conversations, I believe we can ignite change in the mental health field, and more importantly, inspire the next generation of clinicians to find comfort in the therapist chair. Vinitha, I am so excited to be interviewing you today for the podcast.
Happy to be here, Bushra. Thank you so much.
You are my first psychologist on the podcast. You know, after working years in education and talking to students that want to pursue psychology, they always have questions about, okay, should I get my doctorate degree? What's the PhD? What's a PsyD? What does a master's level therapist do? So I'm just excited that I get to interview someone who is doing it, but maybe carries a different degree than most of my interviewees.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the field of mental health has made it easy for anyone to figure out all the different do's and don'ts and the differences in all the letters after your name. And there's so many, you know, every once in a while, I'm like, what's that? I haven't seen that one before. So yeah, I crack the code a little bit with you and figure it out. So happy to help.
I love it. I love it. So I started this podcast similarly with everyone. Where do you feel like your story began as a psychologist? Was there an event, a thought, a conversation that you had that kind of inspired you to go on this track?
Well, I'll tell you where it didn't start. It didn't start in my Psych 101 class at my first day of undergrad. I did not like that class. And I thought, oh my goodness. So I think it goes back more to trying to find that intersection, honestly, between what were some traditional choices, you know, at that time in the culture and in amongst the family friends that we had, and what basically I did not want to do. I knew very clearly that I didn't want to go into engineering. Like my dad, I didn't want to go into the medical field, didn't want to do nursing, you know, so I was like, okay. And then someone asked me, like, what are you good at? I'm like, well, I'm really good at writing. I'm really good at listening. I love puzzles. I love figuring things out. And so it's just sort of naturally evolved into generally like mental health. So sometimes people have a story about like, it's about a family member or something like that. But I think I liked picking things that were different. That's just my core nature, Vinita. You know, like this is very core me to be like, let's do something different. Let's put a twist on this. So I think it started there. And also just, I was that person that everyone went to for advice or suggestions and just get that feedback of like, you're such a good listener. I'm like, can I make a job out of this? You know, but I also like the sciencey stuff. You know, I wanted to understand like the why behind everything. And I might be jumping ahead, but that actually is what led me to psychology versus, you know, like clinical social work or, you know, other things. And not that there is tremendous overlap amongst all the different credentials that we can have. But I almost went into like neuroscience because I liked the why behind what we do. Like the why do we act this way and why do we respond this way? You know, I liked that puzzle.
That's fascinating to me because I think you very clearly kind of stated the difference, right? Well, and this is a generalization that I'm going to make. So correct me if I'm wrong because I don't have my PhD, but perhaps people who do pursue their doctorate in psychology are the people that really love to research, want to understand the why, versus people who maybe have their master's, they're perhaps I think that they are ready to get the ball rolling and dive in with people.
I think that's definitely an important piece. I think whether, you know, I was often, you know, as you progress in your career, people say like, oh, my daughter's interested in psychology. Could you talk to her? Or she's interested in social work. Could you talk to her? And so I've had many coffees with many friends, kids, and, you know, so on as I progressed here. But and many of them said, oh, I don't like research. Like, oh, that sounds so boring. And I said, well, whether you like doing it or not, you need to be a really good consumer of research. So if, you know, psychology emphasizes evidence-based practice quite a bit. I'm not saying that other professions don't. Throughout this conversation, I want to stay in my lane. So I don't want to assume that social work or anything else doesn't do something simply because I state that psychology does. So I'm going to stay just as a little clarity
Absolutely.
there. You know, when people say like, oh, I think research, data, statistics, boring, you know, so I say, well, that's okay. You don't have to be the one doing it. I am thankful for the folks who do it, but you have to still be a good consumer. Many times in clinical practice, people ask me, have you seen this show? Did you see this article? Do diets really work for ADHD? Like, I have to be able to respond to these questions in an intelligent, informed way, and then make that user-friendly to my client. So I think there is an important distinction there where I liked doing the research. Am I a clinical researcher full-time in my profession? Absolutely not, you know, but can I take apart meta-analyses and like kind of understand like, well, that is a sample size of two, so that's not generalizable as another study or things like that. Yes, I can talk that talk for sure. Do I do that every day in my clinical practice? No, I don't. So
I think you're absolutely right, though, and I think that was a learning curve for me as a social worker, that if you're going to be in clinical practice working with people, you better know why you're doing the therapies that you're doing, right? And why does this actually work? I think many times we first fall in love with helping people, but therapy in general is more than just having a conversation. And I think
oh,
that speaks to what you're saying.
I actually just said that when I was amongst friends. I said, you know, in session, it looks like I'm just sort of hanging out, sitting on the couch with you know, just chatting. But there's a lot of wheels turning, and there's, you know, of course, the concept and the practice of attunement and running through a bunch of different hypotheses in my mind of like the why behind and where should I direct the conversation? Where is the client directing the conversation? Does that match? Just to round it out, like I think we all start from the same place, making sure that the client feels respected, safe, most of all, and that we're ready to take on their unique perspective. But I think the greatest compliment for me, or one of the best, is that like, I was able to make a change. Sometimes you want a friend or someone to vent to, and you're not ready for problem solving. You're like, don't give me solutions. I just want to like get the feelings out. And sometimes you're ready for that change. And sometimes you just need a little nudge in that direction. Again, you don't have to exclusively be a psychologist to do that, but I think there's an important sequence there. And most of all, I think what I want to be able to do is replicate the success. It can't be hit or miss with different clients, right? And what is reproducible, those are your evidence-based practices, those are your strategies and techniques and measures, different things. I am who I am in every session with each client on a very consistent basis. There's no coasting here, you know?
No.
So, right? So that's true for many helping professions, but it is particularly important when people come in with such instability, right? That you become their anchor.
I appreciate this conversation already, because I often tell people that this profession is very humbling, because no matter how many years you've been doing this, no matter how many years of education you have, everyone is so different. And you better believe that part of your job will be to research. If I remember correctly, in your bio, you mentioned that you are an immigrant to this country. Can you talk a little bit about that experience as it relates to your education and your practice now?
I think that's an awesome question, and I love the chance to be able to talk about that, Pusha. Thank you. My family is originally from the very southern tip of India, a state called Kerala.
That is the Hawaii of India, for anyone that's hearing this.
all green. Yes, that's a good way of putting it. And my dad immigrated first, and then my mom and I followed. I think I was around age 3 at the time. I don't have any recall of life in India as an infant and, toddler. So what that did was make a unique bond within our family. Like, we were like team figure it out, so like we're parent-teacher conferences, enrolling in elementary school. It's different. The whole process is different from country to country. And so what I found at a very young age was I need to partner with my parents. So they, oh, we're doing this. And, oh, we're all supposed to bring cookies for our birthday. Or this is what, this is what people are doing. And I was like, kind of like the liaison between American culture and our culture at home. My parents they're adorable and privileged to still have them. And they had that spirit already because they chose to immigrate here. It was a choice that they made. So they already had that curious, open-minded sort of go-getter spirit. That intersected well with many things here. And I think that open-mindedness helped me avoid some of the typical pitfalls of saying like, hey, mom and dad, I'm not going to med school. I'm doing this. So they're like, okay. So they've always raised me with the, well, you can do whatever you set your mind to, just go do it, So like, I've always had that when I didn't have the confidence myself, I could borrow it from them. And I saw them walk it every day. So we're like, we don't know how to do this. Well, let's figure it out. And I, more than anything, more than like my father's eyes or my mom's hair or something, I love that I have that quality from them too. They're like, let's go figure it out. And I think that has served me really well with some of the psychology practices, that welcoming attitude, that can-do spirit, that meeting people where they are, being that translator, the interpreter, the liaison, like that really comes into play with the work in autism specifically, cracking the code. That happens every day in my clinical practice. And that's true for the immigrant population, and it's true for my autistic folks too. So I would never have predicted this path, but here we are. In hindsight, it's very clear to me that there are parallels there. Am I saying that autistic people are like immigrants? No, no, I'm not. And nor am I saying immigrants are autistic. So I just want to be really an intersection there that you need to figure out social codes, literal interpretations. Oh my goodness, I can give you a list.
As you're speaking of the experience that you had and have with your parents, I'm just thinking, man, so many of us who are in the South Asian diaspora don't have that experience with our immigrant parents. What would you say? I mean, I guess as someone who seems to have had a supportive environment, for the person who's going into this field and does not have that, maybe their parents are doubtful. Maybe they have a community that makes fun of therapy and psychology in general. What would you tell that individual?
And I think that's a fair question. And I think my parents did have to defend me a bit, So I think within our little unit, we were good because there was mutual trust. And I was a good girl, I was a smart student, 4.0, blah, 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 like all that. So So there's a lot of cultural components that I did check the box, you know, pretty easily. This was the one difference. And did my parents say, no, you can't go into journalism? Yes, they did. You know, so there was, you know, I don't want to understate the fact that there was some tug of war, of course, but not as dramatic as maybe other families and other experiences that I too have heard about. So in fact, Elena, I have heard my parents like defend their, I heard a family member say like, oh, Benita's so smart and so capable. I'm really disappointed in her choice. Again, inside the little unit, we're good, but I think externally, I can definitely relate to that. But now we don't have to look very far to see that mental health touches all of us. We are one unit. We are mind and body. How can we, you know, not understand that interconnection? It seems so basic. It wasn't basic many years ago. It was always talked about in hushed tones. You know, there was a gap in my visiting India for about 5 years, just based on life busyness. And when I went back that second visit, everybody's question was like, what is autism? Is it curable? Is it for your whole life? You know, like, what does that look like? I think I know somebody with that. I didn't know it was called that. I got asked that question every day and I loved it. I was so happy. I read an article about that. It was in the paper. Oh, I saw it on a show, you know, things like that. I'm like, this is fantastic, you know, because I was actually there to do a presentation for a school and I love giving back like that. So, and people would say like, oh, why are you here? What are you doing? And I would say like, oh, I've heard of that. And it used to be like, done in a whisper, like it's a really bad thing, you know, and like it seemed to be more in the public eye, maybe more public health work was done in the time that, you know, between that 5 year gap of visiting. I was very happy to see that. And to going back to your original question, I think we as individuals can accelerate that process by making ourselves relatable. So when I talk to people at parties and, you know, just, you know, the auntie group, sometimes I just very casually drop like, oh yeah, I was talking to a client about this or that. And I can tell that they're like, oh, that's a problem that I've had, you know, like my daughter wants to marry someone who's not within our culture or, you know, child rearing questions or parenting practices or peer pressure, you know, some of the very, very common things. I'm a mom too. So, you know, like very common things that we're all like going through. And they're like, people come to talk to you about that. And they think therapy is like this, some other, like it's only psychosis or something, you know, like some other like faraway thing, you know, they're like, you have to be like so depressed that you can't get out of bed. And that's why you go to therapy. And I'm like, oh, not really. That's not 90% of the people I see. They're very nice people that are interesting and engaging and want to work through something. It's as simple as that, you know.
I think that you're touching on a really important point, because I remember that someone that I know said that I would never be with a man that's in therapy. And I was just like, what? Like, and I think the deeper rooted concern or issue there is that their idea of therapy, and this is someone who's my age, their idea of therapy is people who have severe eating disorders, psychosis, like you mentioned. I mean, like, I think that they're looking at it as in one perspective, but really everyday problems that we all have, everyday yeah. concerns, situations that we mm-hmm. all have, people do seek therapy for that too.
And I don't think the movie industry has helped that at all. Yeah, you know, like what I often say, like therapy isn't like what you see on TV. You know, yes, I have a couch in my office, but you're not laying on it, you know.
Have you ever seen a client lay on our couch? Actually, I think I have one time.
You know, maybe put your feet up, but you know, that's about it. So I used to work a lot more with adolescents, and so they would, you know, slouch all over the place, which I'm like, do what you want, you know. But or with little ones, I would sit on the floor and we, you know, work on a puzzle or craft or something while we talked, you know. So yeah, there's some informality there, but you're not like the cliche, you know. It's still in like, you know, those like Wall Street Journal, like black and white comic strips, and you know, it's still present. It's still part of the culture. And so where do you think immigrants learn about American culture?
Mm.
before you come to this country, you are not learning it directly. You're learning it indirectly through movies and TV and novels. Like, I think my dad's one of his favorite novels was, I forgot which one, but I think Wuthering Heights or one of those Bronte novels where Heathcliff is the main character. I can't remember which novel, but you know, like the wife suffered from mental illness and was locked away in the attic. And I'm like, oh, Dad, we're not doing that. You know, English lit. And he, you know, I said, he's like, and I'm like, do not make that connection. Not what I'm doing. So, but before the nugget in there is that we learn about another culture through the lens of media, right? So, whether that is politics or, you know, pop culture or something more substantive like mental health and wellness or, you know, other things. So I can see why you'd come misinformed, you know. And so I have compassion for the people who have that lens. It was thrust upon them. I don't think they like chose it, you know, like you have to work to kind of counter that. But if this difference in cultural understanding of like what is mental health and like when people go to therapy, they're like Billy Crystal and you know, like sitting on the, you know, like that I could see how that would be a deterrent. You know, and then you have your child saying, I think I want to go into this profession. Parents are like, what are you talking about? You're not going to make any money. You're not going to be able to sustain yourself. What will people say?
It
All of
just
those questions.
adds on.
It just adds on. Yeah, it just keeps going. And I, you know, in my clinical practice and as well as in my coaching business, and I definitely want to touch on it because there's an immigrant piece to that. You know, oftentimes people will say, like, I don't, why are my parents reacting this way? They actually end up, over time, I've seen more and more South Asian clients. And so why is my mom saying this to me? Why and like they're like so doomsday about like this or that choice that I'm making. And I said, it's because many times you have a future plan that they can't picture. Many times they're like, this is tried and true, this is predictable. I've seen it in the past, I've lived that experience, but I can't see what you see ahead of you. And as a parent, that makes me really uncomfortable. As a parent, I still have that protective feeling that I'm the expert, you are my child, you know, hierarchy, that differential. And so I feel like I should guide you. Meanwhile, the young adult is like, I know, no, thank you. I have some plans and I want to figure it out. I might fall down and scrape my knee, and I can do that too. I can figure it out, you know, but it's new territory for the parent. And many times when I tell my young adult client, your mom's scared, they look at me like, are you kidding me? She's like the sassiest person I know. There's fear under there. She's not going to name it. I'm naming it. She's scared for you and about you, and they'll come across as whatever, you know, whatever their default personality is. It'll come across as bossy or know-it-all or strict and controlling or very like directive, you know, things like that. So, but underneath there is like, will my kid be okay? Is the fundamental question, you know, whether it's in their choice of career or life partner or moving, relocating, you know, all of that, you know.
You could be your parents' wildest dream, and they have no idea what's ahead of you. I love that you said that. I love that you said that because I think that builds a little bit of empathy for what an immigrant parent or a parent just in general could be experiencing.
And I think when you have a physical issue, like let's say, oh, I just had a client who, you know, has a young one and they just got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, you know, so a more medical, you know, more concrete, if you will, you know, like you see this specialist, you do these tests, you try these medications, change this, you know, like all, like here's a pump, here's how you use it. It's very like laid out. So there's a at least some framework to go by, right? You start with a pediatrician, you might see an endocrinologist, blah, blah, blah. But in the world of mental health and relationships and interpersonal dynamics and all that, we don't have, as much as we'd like, we don't have a formula, a process that's clear. Like you start here and you end there. We don't have a plan. In my I have a psychology practice. I also have a coaching business that specifically target South Asian women because they are at the peak of the intersection there with the different pushes and pulls of I have to be the expert, but secretly, I don't know what's going on. You know, I don't know how to handle this. How can I be the mom? How can I be the wife? How can I be the professional if I don't know how to do X, Y, and Z? So it's very laser focused coaching. It's called coaching instead of psychology to counteract what I know is a barrier to getting support. I'm me. You're going to get me in every appointment, you know, but sometimes the packaging and the image matters, you know, and I'm meeting, whether it's in my psychology practice or in my coaching business, I am meeting an equal. I am not coming from a place of I am the expert, which goes back to that immigrant mindset too. Like from what I heard from my parents, like in India specifically, their experience was the doctor is the expert in the room. The patient does as they're told. So that's not how we approach things. And so oftentimes I have to reset that in an early session to say, this is more collaborative. You're the expert on you. I'm the expert in psychology. So I think that's important for students to hear. I think that's important for early career folks to hear.
I love that you said that. I wrote this down because I do want to touch on this in our conversation. You have a coaching practice. You have a clinical practice, correct? Coaching business, clinical practice. You are a mom. I also remember us talking about scheduling this conversation, and I had proposed Monday, and you had said, Bushra, I actually take Mondays off just in case my parents need me for appointments, which I definitely can relate to. And something that I have been sort of struggling in my brain about is I think that for a lot of South Asian women, we may have not seen our own mom's work. And if they did, perhaps the career wasn't like the career that you're in right now or the career that I'm in. Maybe they took a huge step back, which is totally fine, and they are entitled and perfectly fine to do that. I guess my question, and maybe this you touch on this in coaching, is what is some advice that you have for the South Asian woman who is maybe the first in her family to want to pursue maybe a master's degree, maybe open up her own business, but also wants the partner and wants the kids? And, you know, how do we kind of balance that when maybe we didn't see someone before us do that?
That is an excellent question. And it comes up a lot in both practices. You know, I hear that a lot, even in social gatherings, you know, like, you know, I want to do this and that and the other. So what I'd love to see is people not labeling like, oh, she's too ambitious. Is there such a thing as too ambitious? You know, I don't think so. Or like she wants to have it all as if that's a bad thing. I think people who are saying that are also going to be the same voices who are like, TikTok, your middle management years professionally are also your peak, you know, I mean, let's be honest there. Those are your peak childbearing years because like, yes, you can have children biologically later in life, but you know, there's more risk and, you know, more often things can be more complicated and there's less predictability, I guess. So I kind of follow the approach of you can have it all, not necessarily all at the same time. So how did that look in my own life? I had a 5-year plan coming out of high school, you know, like I'm going to do this. Well, that 5-year plan did not happen. For someone who was like as organized as I am, some of the most major events in my life happened, I wouldn't say unexpectedly, but like maybe not in the, you know, precise date and time I probably put down in my planner. And I'm truly making fun of myself because I would be like, okay, March 28th at this, you know, I'd be very precise and overly ambitious in my planning. And I think my life lesson has been like, okay, how about we try being flexible a little bit? So what does complete look like for you? So I have many different roles that I am responsible for now. I think there's a place, I'm looking at my weekly planner as I talk to you, there's a place for everything. There's a place for me to work out, to do some of my own like social time that recharges me. There's a place like to walk my dog, you know, like I have to plug it all in, you know, and as long as there are pieces in every week that touch on my core values, you know, have I checked in with my daughters? Are mom and dad okay? Like, you know, did I have some couple time with my husband? You know, did I have some alone time? Because I desperately need that too. And as long as that all is in place in the micro, the macro falls into line, you know.
This is so inspiring to me because first of all, I'm inspired to go get a planner now because I often feel like there's not enough hours in the day. But I love how you said if you can get the micro down, then that will help the macro. Did you have children during your PhD years?
I had them and then went back to school.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so we didn't really touch on education, but like I had a plan to do the PhD all the way through, and that got interrupted because my husband had a really cool promotion and job opportunity that required a relocation. And we had the choice of like living separately for like 3 years, and that's also the time where we're like, we kind of want to start our family too, like towards the end of. So I finished with my master's degree first, and a much longer delay going back to school than I expected because kids came and relocation number two, you know, like life happened, right? And did we have fun and were we happy? Yes. Did we have stress? Yes. But I still had in the back of my mind, like I had a plan to get this PhD. Mm-hmm. I still want that, you know? So I looked at, and here's an important point too, like I try to get myself to settle, mm-hmm. rather, you know, I said, well, maybe I could do this instead, and maybe I could do that. And it just didn't feel right. It didn't, you know, so I said, okay, going back, you know? And so I still remember my little one asking, so I was telling like, mommy got into grad school and so go back to school. And all her whole life, I was a stay-at-home mom. So she said, okay. And then she's like, and then when you're done, then will you be a stay-at-home mommy again? You know, and I was like, I didn't answer because I wasn't going to lie. And I said, I just looked at her and she's like, yeah, I thought so. You know, so, you know, ever since, you know, she was little, I've always been working. And so what I've noticed with both girls is that they notice when I do something that's hard for me more than appreciate it when I make things look easy. And that was a lesson that I had to learn because growing up, I thought I have to look like I have it all together. We all have that idea, right? I have to have it all together. I should look like that. I should never let them see you sweat, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And over time and in many, many conversations with my daughters, I've learned they do admire me and recognize when I do things that are hard for me. I feel very uncomfortable, honestly, with all those images of like that self-sacrificing, you know, unseen person, the invisible, like the behind the scenes person who we see depicted a lot, at, you know, in the mom role in like insert any Hindi movie name, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what are we teaching? I wanted to plan, we have some spring holidays and in the spring is all like the birthday, many birthday, family birthdays at once. And so we have come to like doing just one event for an anniversary and a couple birthdays and, you know, things like that. So I said, okay, it's on my list of things to do today, family, to like, what dessert do you want? You know, everyone gets to pick their favorite thing to cut. And so like, it's on my list today to think it's a couple weeks out, you know, so, or I'll like be like the team leader for like, we're planning a family vacation for July, saying like, you can book the rental car, you can book this, you can, you know, and so like I will lead it because it's easy, honestly easy, you know, it's in my nature to do that, but I don't do it all. Whereas maybe that might have been the role, like at some point, you know, to like pack the lunches and plan everything. And as long as everybody else has a good time, I'm so happy. Like, no, it's my vacation too. So I want to make sure we all have fun. It's not, I think about what everybody likes, you know, and I am naturally like the default, like organizer, fun maker for, you know, the family at times. I'm happy to pass that baton on at some point, you know, but I still am enjoying it. And again, it goes back to like, if I handle the micro, the macro works itself out. So if I start off with, I'm the planner. I need to take it all on. That's not going to work as well as like, hey, I had a couple of cancellations yesterday and it's spring break. And so it's just a little bit of a lighter schedule. We don't have our standing staff meeting. So I have a pocket of time. What can I do with that? So
effective time management.
Yeah, basically. And it's really more like values management too, mixed with time, right? So to say like, how do we make it all fit? What do I want to fit, first of all? And then how do I make it fit? So I think, you know, I just said this at dinner the other day. Like when you ask, what does everybody else want? You also have to ask, what do I want? You might not always get it. You might not always have the answer. You have to ask the question, what do I want?
I love that question. What do I want?
Ask the question. I ask myself every day when I start the day, what do I want, you know, today and or in general, depends on what answer floats up. But if you no one else is asking, you need to ask yourself that question. So, and that's where some of that capableness, the manager of the household, some of those cliche Hindi movie mom types, you know, that's how you can transform that core into a more modern way of being, you know. So they were asking, what does everybody need? Is everybody okay? And like the secret, like mastermind behind the core of the family. Like, honestly, you can take pretty, I just saw Rocky Orani recently. For that, you know, Kabi Hushi, like there's so many movies where there's like this mom who's like secretly like handling things, right? Like this core person. So to transform that to the more modern age would be to say, yes, I can, I'm intuitive, so our therapist and psychologist. Yes, I am empathic. I know what each person needs. I'm compassionate about it. I also need to do that for myself. And so that's really a cool intersection between psychology practice and being that more balanced person and getting a more balanced like life.
By the way, as you're speaking, I'm like, oh man, like I wish we had more time. Because I have so many other questions for you. But I like to end the podcast with asking folks what changes they'd like to see in the mental health field. So if you can touch on that, I think that would be great.
Sure. I am active in a lot of like national groups, and I've taught grad school for many years as well. And I think there's still the mindset of I am in this field and it's a personal sacrifice. And I wish that wasn't the case. You know, I wish that we were paid in an equitable way. You know, I think that even within the profession, there's a change over to like private pay practices or non-insurance based practices. And that is a pendulum swing. You know, I've seen that, like where a lot of reimbursement rates are back in the 90s and, you know, early 2000s in terms of rate. That is not sustainable in this current economy, right? And so that is an inherent barrier to being successful. So that is definitely one. And I think an increasing focus on, actually going back to the beginning of this conversation, an increasing focus on science and research-based practices, evidence-based practices and strategies. We have so much access to really cool technology like fMRIs and like the research that goes with that, that can really help add substantive like credibility to the practices that we adopt every day in our offices, in our clinical rooms. And what recently a new client said, well, you seem more sciencey. And I said, well, thank you. You know, I appreciate that. You know, he's like, I don't know what the word is. I don't know but it's like sciencey. And I said, okay, this is good. You know, and that's what leads to change. So I think that needs to ripple out into, you know, the culture at large, like the why behind, like try this parenting hack or this parenting tip, and then also explain the why behind it so that the parent can reproduce it in everyday life with their kids, or a strategy to address that analysis paralysis that comes sometimes with my ADHD folks. You know, they'll like overthink, and get stuck and then feel bad and have this like negative cycle. So how to break through that when you're not in session with me, you know, like what do you need to hear in your own mind and what strategies and the why behind it to try. I think that makes things more reproducible and just more approachable. So
I do want to touch on both things. things that you mentioned. So when you said personal sacrifice, the first thing that I thought about was the mental toll that this work can have on people, whether you are starting, whether you are interning in this field, or you've been in this field for a long time, there's a mental toll that comes about. And you talked a lot about the income and the insurance reimbursement. And I think that the reason why we sometimes feel this mental toll is because if you're working for a practice, that practice most likely would like you to meet a minimum of X amount of clients. And so you're trying to gain those clients. You're trying to keep those clients. And at the same time, even then, it doesn't seem like it's enough money because you might be taking insurance. So I do think that there's this domino effect. And I think to your point, it starts with the insurance companies.
Yeah, definitely. We need to be made whole. You know, the work is hard. The work has its own emotional toll that we're not even talking about. We're talking, you know, but we can't quantify that, right? I mean, we need our healthy strategies, our abilities to compartmentalize, and all of those clinical practices that we need to do to keep ourselves intact and effective in session. But that is not quantifiable or reimbursable, right? So that's something that's kind of part and parcel of what we need to do as a professional. The counterpart to that is, like, you know, we're in school for a long time to do this. This is not just some, you know, like psychology and like on the surface seems so approachable, right? Because it applies to all of us. Like not all of us need cataract surgery, or not all of us need an insulin pump, or, you know, something that specialized, but we all need an understanding of our minds and how our emotions work and cognition. And so I think somehow I feel like people end up discounting that because I don't know how to explain it. It's like a double-edged thing. Like it's psychology for everybody, and yet there are specialists. So are you gatekeeping? You know, what is that? Where don't people go through the door of needing cataract surgery, or only certain people go through that other door of XYZ medical procedure? Not, it doesn't apply to everybody. So how do we be experts and specialists and be approachable at the same time? That's tricky. That's a very tricky justification. You know, like, yes, I'm approachable and I'm your person. And then what will I get from you that I can't get from a friend? So that's important. That's on us. That's on us as a profession, as a whole, to be able to articulate that. I think we could do a better job. I'm going to leave that to the next generation of professionals to do. That's your goal, Pusha. Like, let's articulate that a little bit better.
Oh gosh, you're talking to the generation of like pop psychology, right? Like,
That's what I get from a specialist that I can't get from Instagram and TikTok, you know, like, right? So
absolutely.
Like, my client who came in and like, I took all these quizzes and tests already, and I think I'm autistic. Okay.
I was going to touch on that with you, if whether or not you're seeing an influx of people coming in thinking that they have autism.
Yes. And so I point to the pretty blue book in the back and I say, you know, I have some rules and guidelines that I need to follow. It's not just about eye contact, or it's not just about being uncomfortable in social situations. There's a whole collection of features, qualities, you know, ways of being. And, you know, if someone's doing that level of self-study, I definitely want to respect that. If you're studying this, then, you know, I definitely want to respect that qualitative, you know, information. And then my job, I often say this phrase to potential clients, like, it would be very easy for me to say, sure, yes, and have an autism diagnosis. Here you go. I can sign off. My job is actually to see, am I missing something? Is it some other, like, basically the different. My job is to make sure that we haven't missed something in your history, that isn't, there's not some alternate explanation that is a better fit, because this one, it would be easy to say, sure, you can't focus, you have ADHD, like that, right? Like, you are late all the time, ADHD free, you know, like that would be easy, you know. And then often my clients laugh and say, like, oh, okay, I get it, you know. But my job is to make sure I'm not missing something. That's on me, you know.
Absolutely. And I think that's where your research comes in, the importance of research comes in, right? That, you know, it's not enough just to talk like you're on Instagram. where you're giving people just a very quick outline of what depression looks like, what autism looks like, what anxiety looks like.
And I think there's a place for that. I think people feel very isolated and alone in those situations. And to have a just a little moment where you're like, it's not just me, you know, like that's important too, but that's not all of it, right? That should be just like cracking the door open a little.
Clients appreciate the science.
Oh yeah.
They
They
do.
won't say it in so many words, but they do.
I appreciated this conversation so much, and I
Me
respect you so much, and I'm excited for people to listen, and they're probably going to have questions. So, I will mention your Instagram handle and your website after this podcast, but I just so many thanks thrown your way, because I think that this was such a great opportunity for you to talk a little bit about all the various things that you're doing, and then also just the experiences and how people can hopefully navigate this career with a little bit more clarity.
I think it's great. I think we need more people like us in the field. And that was one of the main reasons I reached out to you, because if we can be just, you know, like holding up the light for someone else, right? And say like, it's okay. We actually need more. Like everyone, every subgroup needs to take care of their own, right? And I think that's
Yes.
really important to me. And part of why like I participated as like youth in youth groups as a kid and then as leaders later, because we have to be able to see yourself in the future, right? I think there needs to be some sort of guide. And I love that you're doing that with this podcast and your other work. And I really want to thank you for the opportunity, to hang out with you this morning.
Well, thank you, and we will talk soon. I will field any questions your way, and hopefully people will connect with you, reach out to you to learn more.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again for listening to this episode of Ignite the Change. If you'd like to follow Vinitha on social media, you can find her on Instagram at Dr. Vinitha Menon. If you're interested in therapy and would like to reach out to Vinitha, feel free to head to mythrivecollective.com. If you have questions about her coaching program for Indian women in any location, you can email Vinitha at info@thethrivemind.co to learn more.